focus on Hagar, a woman who has a tragic story. And to get us a bit in the sense of that story, to help us to understand it and feel some of the emotions of Hagar, I just want to show a video of a song. It's a song from Hillsong United, and it would just give us a bit of an understanding of some of the emotions and some of the experience that Hagar went through.
Take this fainted
Isaiah Smith there, can you, with that song? Today we're going to hear about Hagar and Ishmael, and I'm going to focus on grace. But first I want you to see my favourite band when I was at high school and just after. U2. You may not recognise them, you guys, but that's how I remember them. Those were the glory days of U2, this fresh-faced, ruddy-cheeked group of guys from Dublin. And they were full of power of God. They'd just been converted. They had these amazing songs. At the last U2 concert I went to, Bono was up front talking, as he does an awful lot at his concerts. And anyway, he was talking about Father Abraham. And he talked about how Abraham is the father of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. So he was saying that Muslims, Jews, and Christians should all be able to get along a bit better because we all have the same father, Father Abraham. I was a bit challenged by that at the time, and I've been thinking a lot about it. But tonight you will hear of the decision that actually has led to the creation of a couple of those faiths. And then in Galatians we see a distinction that Paul makes for the third faith. So we'll get to that. But first of all, I want to talk about grace. This is a quote from Tim Keller. Grace comes to those who don't deserve it, those who continually resist it, those who do not appreciate it when they receive it. We will look at those themes as they weave their way through the story tonight. Unfortunately, last week you found out that Sarah gets pregnant. I'm really disappointed by that because it completely stuffs the dramatic flow of the story. But I want you to try and pretend you didn't hear the sermon last week. Okay, you don't know the happy ending. We're sort of winding back the clock. We've got Genesis 15 when Abraham and Sarai are told again that God is going to bring them a son. But basically, we're still in the waiting period. So let's pretend that actually you don't know what's going to happen. And you go back in time to that time when Abraham and Sarai are waiting. They've left their family, they've left their home, they've left the place where they were born, they've come all this way, they've popped down to Egypt, they've come back up, and they're waiting and they're waiting. And I wonder if you've ever had to wait, if you've ever had to wait on God. Have you ever questioned God's timing? Have you ever questioned his response? Why is he so slow sometimes? Why has God held back a good thing? So I want you just to turn to the person next to you and tell them of one time when you had to wait, or even if you're still waiting right now. So just a quick share, just for a couple of minutes. Waiting. When have you waited on God? Waited for God to respond. Okay, we might pull it back. You can continue your sharing a little bit later. When there's laughing from the youth, you know that the time is right to bring it back. Stay focused. I want to tell you about a guy who knew about waiting, Charles Spurgeon, the great preacher. from the 19th century. I heard this quote just in the last week, and it really touched me. God is too good to be unkind. He is too wise to be confused. If I cannot trace his hand, I can always trust his heart. And Spurgeon said that even though his wife Susanna was sick a lot of the time. In fact, she became an invalid at the age of 33, and she died at the age of 36. She was too ill most of the time to hear him preach. She only heard him a couple of times. This is a man who was such a famous preacher that at one point in his preaching career, and I'm waiting for this opportunity, he preached to 23,000 people in London without a microphone. What an amazing orator. But I'm sure he knew what he was saying in this quote. He knew what it was to wait on God and not understand what God was doing, perhaps, but trusting in God. But it's hard to trust. It's hard to trust anyone these days. We could trust the government, but sometimes it fails. How can we trust the government who botches up very important things like the census? Another group that maybe we could trust is the police force. But I don't know if you heard about this story this week. Andrew Scipione, the police commissioner, went out to Bowraville, where for 25 years they've been waiting for the police to say sorry. What happened was 25 years ago, three children of Bowraville went missing. And now, at last, the police commissioner admitted that the police didn't do enough at the time. They botched up the investigation and they completely ruined the chance of bringing the criminal to justice, and he said sorry and promised a reinvestigation. Perhaps the people we always thought we could trust were ministers of religion, but of course we've had so many stories and examples from the Royal Commission on the Institutional Response to Child Sexual Abuse, so many stories that have just shaken our trust of church and ministers. Who can we trust? Can we trust God? Well, Abraham didn't trust God. I don't know if you remember back to Genesis 12 when they were going down to Egypt. Abraham didn't trust that God would provide. He didn't trust that God would protect. So he told Sarai she had to pretend that she was his sister, and she got taken into Pharaoh's harem. Thankfully, God rescued them. He made Pharaoh's household very sick, and Pharaoh was quite happy to release Sarai back to Abraham. And in fact, there was a blessing that came out of that, because Pharaoh also gave them stock and slaves. And this is probably the moment when Hagar actually joined the household. Actually, at that time, she was an Egyptian slave, and she joined them at that time, probably. And of course, we know from the story tonight that Sarai didn't trust God either. Even though they'd had all these promises, she decided that she would have a plan to make sure that Abraham would have a son. The plan sounds pretty ridiculous these days, doesn't it? Some people would prefer this sort of story wasn't in the Bible, but there it is in all its gritty human glory. Sarai says, "Abraham, you know, it's not really working out between us, but here is my slave, Hagar. Why don't you sleep with her? She can give you the son that we've been hoping for." Abraham didn't fight the the suggestion. He went along with it. And in fact, Hagar probably wasn't too unhappy about it either in lots of ways, because her status was about to change. Her status as a slave was virtually no rights at all, and she would become elevated by actually participating in this. Around this time, it was actually quite a conventional thing to do. It's hard to imagine, but barrenness in women was not unusual at this time. And part of the solution was that slaves were part of the household. They were part of the property of the people. Therefore, if you actually slept with a slave and produced an heir, the heir would be accepted as part of the family. It was a way of perpetuating the family. So it was common practice. Sarai's idea was that this would go ahead. They went along with it, and Hagar became pregnant. However, things quickly went wrong. Hagar didn't trust Sarai. She starts treating Sarai with disdain. Why did she do that? Well, probably a few reasons. First of all, she probably felt used by Sarai. Secondly, she might not have trusted what would happen once the child was born. You see, what could have happened, again, quite legitimately in those times, is that Sarai could have taken the baby as her own child, and she could have just rejected and sent away Hagar. Hagar might never have had the chance to see her child grow up. I wonder if Sarai was jealous of Hagar's fruitful womb. Maybe Sarai actually contributed to this. Maybe she could not accept this woman who had slept with her husband. And maybe Hagar had become attached to Abraham and resented Sarai. We're not really sure how this begins to happen. All we know that there is this terrible relationship that develops between these women where they begin to despise each other. Sarai goes to Abraham and she says to him, "We need to get rid of this woman." In fact, the way she talks about it is pretty graphic. In chapter 16, verse 5, in the NIV, it puts it in sort of nicer language than is actually there in the Hebrew. So in verse 5, when Sarai says to Abraham, "Here is this woman that I placed in your arms," she actually says, "Here is this woman that I placed in your lap." It's actually quite graphic language. It's the language of anger. It's the language of humiliation. It's the language of shame. Abraham agrees that Sarai can treat Hagar any way she wants. And again, the NIV glosses over what happens next, because in verse 6, when it talks about Sarai ill-treating Hagar, it's the same word that ill-treat is the same word that ironically is used in Exodus 5 for the Egyptians when they ill-treat the Hebrew slaves who aren't making enough bricks for them. In other words, Sarai is actually beating Hagar. Not surprisingly, Hagar flees. From the information we have about where she's going, she's actually trying to head back home to Egypt. But here is a pregnant woman running through the desert. There are wild animals, there are robbers, there are thieves. She could die of thirst or starvation. She's incredibly vulnerable. And something astonishing happens. The angel of the Lord comes to Hagar. He promises her that she will be the mother of a great nation. She's not looking for that. She's just looking to somehow survive at this point. And there is this amazing promise. She will be the mother of a great nation. You will have a son called Ishmael. Ishmael means God hears. This is an incredible promise for her. But there's also a warning. There's going to be enmity. There's going to be enmity between the sons of Abraham. And here we have the seed of the great conflict that actually still impacts on our world today. You see, the Quran recognizes Hagar as the mother of Islam. And Sarah is the mother of Israel. And just as it says in verse 12 of chapter 16, they will continue to live in conflict. In fact, I wonder if you saw this incident that happened during the Olympics, brilliantly timed for my sermon, might I say, but here we have the Egyptian in the heavyweight judo division, Islam El Shahabi. He was beaten by an Israeli. At the end of a judo match, you're supposed to face each other, bow and shake hands. Islam El Shahabi refused to shake the hand of his Israeli victor. Here, even on the world stage, in front of all the cameras, in an event that's supposed to be about peace amongst all the nations, even here there is enmity between these two. And what about Hagar? It's extraordinary. Hagar is a woman. She's a slave. She's outside the covenant. Why would God intervene?
In verse 13, it says that she names God. You are the God who sees me. I have seen the one who sees me. Why does God do this? Well, I think it's grace. Grace comes to those who don't deserve it, to those who aren't even looking for it. God brings grace to her. And this is one of the things I love about the Bible. You cannot make this stuff up. Like, if you were going to put this nice story together about the God of the universe and his people, and you would never have a Hagar incident, and you would never have God appearing to her in the desert and saving her and making these promises and looking after her and allowing himself to be named by her. But this is what happens. And how does Hagar respond to this grace? She is obedient. She goes back to that household. She goes back to the conflict with Sarai. We don't know what happens. There's nothing in the Bible that says how they got along, but later incidents suggest it was still a very hard time for her. But she returns. She has the baby, Ishmael. God hears. Let's fast track to what we heard last week. Chapter 17, the promises come again to Abraham and Sarai. Abraham's name is changed to Abraham. He will be the father of all nations. And Sarai's name is changed to Sarah, and they are told they will have a son called Isaac. And then the miracle happens, as we heard last week. A 90-year-old, formerly barren, postmenopausal woman is impregnated by her 100-year-old husband and gives birth to a healthy son, Isaac. But I wonder, how is Hagar feeling at this moment? The covenant has been fulfilled. Everyone's really joyful, but how is Hagar? Okay, another little pause. Talk to the person next to you. How do you think Hagar might feel about this? What is her position now in the household? What is going to happen to Ishmael? What is her emotion at this time? Just a couple of minutes to chat. Okay, we'll just pull it back again. I particularly liked that there were a few groups where there were men talking about what it felt like to be Hagar. It was just a very joyful moment for me. Thank you for doing that, guys. Okay, we get an insight into the story. We don't know exactly how she was feeling, but probably her fears came true relatively quickly. So the rest of the story is in chapter 21 of Genesis, and I'll just sort of summarise some of it for you. We'll go through it, but if you want to follow, feel free to turn there. So in Genesis 21, Isaac is having his weaning feast. I don't know if any of you had a weaning feast, but apparently that was a popular thing to do at this time. And Ishmael is there, and Ishmael starts jesting or mocking Isaac, and Sarah sees this. Now here is, I think, one of those delightful moments of irony in the Bible, because what have Sarah and Abraham both done? They have laughed at God and somehow managed to get away with it. But here we have Ishmael laughing at Isaac, and Sarah's immediate response is, get rid of that woman and her son. Send them away. This time Abraham puts up a little bit of resistance, for which I'm grateful, but he does it mostly for the sake of his son. He's concerned about his son, and he's reassured by an angel that his son will be the forerunner of a great nation. His son will be okay. So So Abraham agrees to let him go, gives them a bit of water, a few provisions, and once again, Hagar is sent out into the desert, this time with Ishmael. Well, the provisions run out, and at this point, Hagar is desperate. She's out in the desert with her son. She doesn't know what to do. He's going to die. So what she does is she lays him underneath a bush, and then she goes far enough away that she won't have to watch or hear him die. What is going to happen? For the second time, God shows up. And just a sideline here, we know that Sarah received grace. She had her answers fulfilled. She was no longer a barren woman. She had the promise fulfilled. She had the son. How did she respond to grace? How did she respond to Hagar? It doesn't appear as if she received that grace and she was changed by it. But God is not limited to human actions. God steps outside of those actions. He hears Ishmael and he responds. So verse 17 and onwards in chapter 21, God heard the boy crying, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What is the matter, Hagar? Do not be afraid. God has heard the boy crying as he lies there. Lift the boy up and take him by the hand, for I will make him into a great nation." Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. So she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. God saves Hagar again and Ishmael. And in fact, they go on to go down. She fetches a wife for him from Egypt. Now that well that God opened her eyes to, in the Quran, that's renamed the Spring of Zamzam. The Spring of Zamzam is actually part of the Hajj, the annual pilgrimage of the Muslims. Every year, millions of Muslims go to the Spring of Zamzam and they take a drink of that water. The Spring of Zamzam is actually just 20 metres, stone's throw, east of Kaaba, which is the most sacred place of Islam. It's actually the exact point to which Muslims kneel and pray five times a day. Every single year, Muslims reenact this story of Hagar and how God visited her in the desert. So, we have these two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. We have these two religions portrayed. But how does this relate to Christianity? Galatians 4 tells us how, and we heard that read tonight by Ben. In Galatians 4, Paul actually contrasts these two things. He's actually contrasting Judaism and Christianity. And he talks about the way of works, which is Hagar. He says, you have this way where you have to work to God, where you actually try and please God by what you do. And that's what Hagar represents. You're actually a slave to the law. And then he describes Sarah as the way of grace. He says there is this other way. And of course, that is the way that has been opened up by Jesus. It's the way of freedom. You can't earn it. You have to receive it by grace. Grace comes to those who don't deserve it, those who aren't looking for it or who continually resist it, those who do not appreciate it. But I want to say, let's not be like Sarah. May grace actually soften our hearts. May grace change our hearts. May grace actually transform us. May we be obedient like Hagar in response to grace. And may we be agents of grace. There is an institute around. It's named after Hagar. It's the Hagar Institute. And that is a group of Christians who are actually fighting against modern day slavery. I found these figures quite confronting. There are approximately 35 million slaves today. That is much more than the population of Australia. They say approximately 68% are involved in economic slavery, and that's like Hagar, involved in forced domestic work, or it could be in agriculture or construction or mining. And 22% are involved in sex slavery. Again, you could argue that that was Hagar's lot. Of those, 75% are women and girls. 60% women, 15% girls, and the rest men and boys. They say that child trafficking is on the increase. And if we think that this is not part of our problem, more than half of all of that occurs in our region. It's estimated there are 20 million slaves in the Asia-Pacific region, right in our back door. Amazing Grace is a hymn that was written by a former slave trader, John Newton, whose heart was softened by grace. He turned around and he started fighting with William Wilberforce against the slave trade. He offered freedom and hope to others, and he left us this wonderful hymn to actually celebrate it. You see, we have this story of Hagar and Grace. She had been enslaved, she had been used, she'd been abused, she'd been abandoned. But God saved her twice. He saw her, she named God, she saw God. And I think we are enslaved, used, abused, and abandoned by sin. But God sees us. He hears us. He has reached out to us through Jesus, and he offers us freedom. If I was the only person in the world, God would still have sent his son Jesus to die for me, to open up a way, to satisfy his wrath, to demonstrate his love. And if you were the only person in the world, God would still send his son Jesus for you. So tonight we have an opportunity to again be amazed by God's grace, to be transformed by that grace, and to be agents of grace. My challenge to you this week is to actually respond to that grace. Is there someone that God is putting on your heart to be kind to? Is there someone that God is asking you to give something to? May not be something worth money, it may be the gift of your time. Is there someone you need to forgive? Is there a way that you could empower someone by encouraging them or perhaps teaching them something? Do you need to say sorry? Do you need to say thank you? Be thankful to God for the needy people he brings across your path. And I challenge you this week to look around you and see if you can see someone who is marginalised, the Hagars of the world. Is there someone around that you see who is alone, who is sad, who is desperate for grace? But most of all, I think we need to receive God's grace offered to us in Jesus. As the band come up, we're going to sing about that grace, and I'll just pray. Father God, thank you so much for this story of Hagar. Thank you for your grace poured out on her, someone who didn't deserve it, who wasn't looking for it, and yet you showed her grace. Thank you that even though we don't deserve it, even though we resist it, even though we don't appreciate it when we receive it, I pray that you would help us to receive your grace offered to us through Jesus. And I pray that in receiving it, we would have our eyes opened, we would have our hearts transformed so that we would offer grace to others, that we would be changed by that grace, that we'll be renewed in our fervour to serve you and serve others, and that we would see what we can do to make someone else's life, a person like Hagar, easier and show them the grace that you showed Hagar. Father God, help us never to take the grace that you offer us through Jesus for granted, and help it to be real to us. Amen. We're going to sing two songs, and the second song will actually be an offertory song. So if you're a regular member of the congregation, be generous. Here's an opportunity to respond to grace. And if you're a visitor, just let it pass you by. And I hope you enjoy the service. Thank you.